Ilostrovsky's screams, undercut by wet gurgles and the thick, wet sound of tearing meat. One shoulder against the wall, she stumbled through the darkness, blind and helpless. She screamed again. She screamed in pain. She screamed for help. But mostly, she screamed to try to drown out the noises behind her. But no matter how loud she screamed, she could still hear them. Chapter 4. The Basilica Gravenator always made Ostap feel small and insignificant. Then again, it was meant to do so. The architect had intended for visitors called before the Gravenate to be reminded of their insignificance and to be struck immediately with a respect for the scope of the body they stood before. Guests, those called to give testimony, or other officials of the planetary government were seated within the Occurium, the open section of the grand meeting room which sat below even the ground level. Wealthy merchants, generals, foreign traders, all were expected to descend the two steps into the Occurium to acknowledge their obeisance to the governing body of Shokan. Unless they were being called for criminal testimony, those in the Occurium were still furnished with elegantly padded chairs and functional mantis wood desks to show that the resources and generosity of the Gravenate extended even to the lowest citizens allowed in their presence. The rectangular perimeter of the ground level was seated with alcoves for the Greves. Each Greve occupied their own large area, furnished with desks topped by white veined marble that rested on legs shaped like curled raptor's talons. Each alcove was decorated in rich fabrics that showed the family colours of the Greve who was stationed there. Between each alcove, huge columns, carved from polished black basalt supported by steel cores, rose from the pure white marble floors to support the level above. Each column was crowned by a gold aquila, its wings stretched to either side, as though bearing the weight of the next level on their mighty pinions. The second level was open, ringing the same perimeter as the first, so that the long greaves who presided there could look down upon those below them. The long greaves were fewer in number than the greaves, and so their alcoves were much larger. Their desks bore signets of their house arms, each carved from a single large piece of precious material such as silver, jade, or crystal. Amplifiers in their alcoves allowed their words to be broadcast in booming volume to those below. The aquilas which perched atop the columns of the second floor were larger and more fierce than those of the greaves, with barbed talons and fearsome screeching faces. The third floor, the domain of the Margreves, was more impressive yet. Below each alcove hung a banner depicting the arms of their house. The arms on the titanic desks of the Margreves were intricate embellishments of their usual family crests. The aquilas atop the third tier columns were the biggest yet, clutching clusters of ripe fruit and bundles of broken swords in their fierce claws. Their alcoves were more sizable still than those of the Longreves, as large as small amphitheatres. Even with the massive size of their alcoves, the smaller number of Margreves left space between their seats of power, which contained enormous marble tablets to bridge the gap. Covered in sculptures in high relief, they showed the glorious servants of the God Emperor of mankind triumphing over his many enemies. The dome of the Basilica Gravenator yawned above the tier of the Margreves. Pendentives rose from the rectangular walls to support the circular walls of the dome. Low-relief images, sculpted into the pendentives, showed a line of forms, each depicting one of the militant forces in service to him upon the throne. A sister of the Adepta Sororitas, a soldier of the Astra Militarum, a pilot of the Aeronautica Imperialis, each had their place in the line with the Adeptus Arbites, the Adeptus Astartes, and others Ostap couldn't name, all staring down in judgment and readiness at the assembly below. Above them, the great dome stretched, covered in a vast fresco of holy terror as seen in transit across its home star. The great sphere, painted so as to appear to be curving out towards the viewers beneath, had been painstakingly rendered in vibrant shades of blue and green, A reminder of the life that had once thrived there before growing and scattering across the galaxy. Golden beams, decorated with hammered leaf and meant to represent the glittering light of Sol, arched down from the ceiling to meet the pendentives. It was a building that meant to send a message, to remind those who did not belong that they were insignificant, and to remind those who trod its halls that they were mortal, merely tiny threads in a tapestry larger than any of them. It was an august structure meant to enforce, by its very atmosphere, mindfulness and gravitas for the important proceedings which took place within. At the moment, though, it was in the grip of madness.
"A complete annihilation!"
bellowed Langrev Oldemeyer.
"We stand upon the cusp of an utter destruction of the ruling line!"
The assembled ruling nobles were in turmoil, yelling to be heard over one another, breaking into side squabbles and ignoring Trenchat's tenets of decorum entirely. The terrifying sight of the Grevenate occupying their alcoves was a useful one for cowing witnesses and guests into submission. But when the members met without outsiders present, they used the close quarters of the Occurium where they could speak or scream face to face.
"The line of succession remains clear,"
Greve Pitsak pounded his desk to be heard over the din.
"And Lord Governor Ashel remains alive and healthy. This very meeting borders on treason."
A robust man, his was one of the youngest houses, whose business was seated firmly in the service industry, namely Orvox herding. Although his house was regarded as essentially an adjunct to the Matkesons, since their industry was entirely subservient to that of the governing families, Grigor Pritzak was more than willing to use his beefy frame and booming voice to command the respect that his elitist peers might be reluctant to grant him based on his title alone.
"I would remind Grev Pritzak that ensuring the safe succession of the Lord Governor's office is within the domain of the Grevenate."
Irena Venason smiled sweetly.
"A fact the more experienced members of this body are well aware of."
A titter of laughter swept through the crowd of lords and ministers. The Venason's daughter's mockery brought a moment of peace to the proceedings, which she was quick to capitalize upon.
"There is no thought of treason here," she said. "The collected company here thinks only to safeguard the security of the planetary government."
Although technically speaking, Irena was not the head of her house, neither was Ostap. Conducting the work involved in running an entire noble family, and the commercial concerns that had seen the family elevated in the first place, as well as participating in the planetary governance, was an unreasonable expectation for many of the family heads. The members of the Grevenate were therefore empowered to name a minister to sit in their place and speak with their voice. As Vicereine, Acilia Venason was entitled to a Margrave seat and usually delegated that seat to her daughter Irena. Bearing the honour of that delegated responsibility was something Ostap and Irena had in common. The only thing, he hoped. Ostap's own family, dominant in the cart and carriage trade, were located on Shokan's smallest continent, far from Kostovium. His father, Grev Olan Fominko, had little interest in the politics of the capital. Like more than a few of the lesser Grevs, he considered the position of so little importance that he hadn't even bothered to send his eldest child. Ostap was the third Fominko child, and the distant capital had been a banishment. Grev Fominko wasn't alone in his feelings. In the Grevenate, the vote of each noble was weighted by the tier they occupied. For the base Grevs of the lowest tier, there was often a feeling of having little real voice in the chamber.
"Is Lord Governor Matkesson truly well?"
asked Tenesh Bruziel. The elderly matriarch rarely participated when the Grevenate descended into screaming matches, preferring to wait until things had quieted before making her opinions known.
"We have been given word that she has survived, but has she deigned to make a public appearance since the attempt on her life?"
Ostap bristled. Margrave Bruziel was a frequent critic of the palace and could always be counted on to support the coadjutor. In the weeks since someone had attacked Ashiel Mackeson, Tanesh had lent her support to any argument that implied the governor was too unwell to lead, which was by no means a new development. Before the assassination attempt, the lords, loyal to the Venetians, had tried to undermine Ashiel's autonomy by suggesting that without an heir she was unfit to govern. Propositions had included passing resolutions to require her to choose a partner, or naming the coadjutor heir to the throne temporarily until such time as Ashiel had produced a child. None had got past the point of opening arguments, but the fact that the lords who counted themselves as Venetian allies had been emboldened enough to even discuss such matters spoke to how much fear was running through the Basilica Grevenator following the death of Ruprecht and Jordan Matkison. Ostap Fominko had never counted himself among the Venetian allies, nor among the more numerous Greves whose loyalties shifted with the winds, in accordance with whatever benefited them most at the time. Very early in his career, he'd made the mistake of using his position as his father's minister to edge in some legislation which benefited his family, and authorised the sale of carriages to a stone shipping concern to replace their horse-drawn wagon teams, the animals and carts of which had been in a state of serious decrepitude. Unknown to him, those wagon teams had been supplied by Tanzeg Venetian. The drivers who had attempted to deliver the Fominko carriage fleet had met with disaster, waylaid on their journey and killed to the man, the carriages looted and burned. It was a wrong that Ostap had not forgotten, and he had spent every day in the Grevenate since then dedicated to spoiling the works of the Venetians and anyone beholden to them. It had earned him few friends, but those families loyal to the Matkesons had noticed his zeal, and his family's fortunes had increased as a result. The Matkesons in particular had, after the first few years of his service, replaced their entire carriage fleet with Fominko models, a service that had only increased his loyalty to them.
"She isn't required to," Ostap said.
Now that the chamber had returned to something approaching normalcy, he could be heard. His arguments were often overshadowed by the louder, more boisterous lords and ministers around him, just as he was usually overshadowed in life. Ostap was a man of small stature and small presence. He had a keen mind for details and was quite skilled as an administrator, but he lacked the charisma of the leaders he was surrounded by. He had long ago given up trying to cultivate a bold or magnetic appearance, and now merely went about his business in the conservative robes of a professional clerk. He cropped his hair short and no longer neglected the crystal spectacles he required to see anything up close. But if he had got their attention for a moment, he was going to use it.
"Group Captain Baron, acting head of the High Service, has testified that she is alive and on the mend. Her official statement of the attack, sealed with her own signet and delivered in her handwriting, has been seen by every member of this body."
Ostap stood, feeling his anger rise. How dare they?
"She fought off her attacker by hand and was grievously wounded in the process, yet still manages to answer our missives, still manages to authorise the shipments to the Calistonian Haven. In one night she shed more blood for the government of this world than most of the members of this assembly."
There was a roar of outrage, but he raised his voice, fury giving him an edge that he usually lacked.
"The Lord Governor has endured more personal tragedy in a single month than anyone here. She has lost her Lord Governor and father, her beloved sibling, and several of her most trusted personal servants."
Ostap pointed emphatically skyward.
"And yet," he yelled, "she continues to serve. How shameful would this body be if we look upon such strength and question her fitness?"
The yelling began again as he sat, with some lords cursing him and others, echoing his words. Ostap could barely even make out individual arguments. He could see the faces of lords like Tanesh Bruziel, Yuri Oldemeyer and Lagaret Gvozny, though. The faces of the staunch Venetian supporters were pinched and angry, mouths clenched in silence. Their votes weighed more heavily in the chambers of the Grevenate, but not so heavily that they could overcome the mass of the lower-tier Greves. And those Greves were energized. Having seen their Lord Governor rise triumphant from disaster, they would not turn on her. At least, Ostap reflected, not for now. Tanzeg held one hand out. A bustling servant wiped the smear of vitiberry paste from the cuff of his dining robe. Returning his hand to his data slate, he flipped through the news idly.
"The Grevenate is rallying behind her," said Acilia.
She folded her newsprint and dropped it to the table. With the matriarch as coadjutor, the Venaissans were more than capable of receiving sector news, at least that which was available to the astropaths aboard the Calistonian. What constituted news to the general plebeian public of Shokan, however, was still distributed by primitive folded news sheets. Tanzeg never bothered to read them. There was rarely anything of importance there. If there was, he certainly already knew about it some time before the sheet printers had got hold of the rumours. Not that he needed briefing by his contacts in order to know all about how the lesser Greves had rallied, eager to show their support for their liege in the 2 weeks since the failed attempt on Ashiel Mackinson's life.
"Nothing boasts the public's confidence in a ruler like seeing them survive an assassination attempt," said Irena.
Acilia gave her younger child a wan smile, and Irena wriggled like a puppy that had been told that indeed it was a good girl. Tanzeg studied the freshly cleaned cuff. The vitiberry paste had better not stain the rich fabric. He glanced up to make a note of which serving girl had wiped the glob away. If the robe didn't clean properly, he intended to have her whipped each time it came back from the cleaner. Acutely aware of his mother's cold fury, he finally looked away from his wrist. The two women stared at him over the breakfast table. Acilia didn't even have a plate in front of her. He didn't know why she bothered taking breakfast with them anymore. She scarcely ate a thing. Like the truly elderly, she seemed to subsist on nothing but boiled oats and spite. He'd long since outgrown any expectations of her dying natural causes before his second century and resigned himself to inheriting his family fortunes in a few decades, if at all. There were still plenty of diversions to be had in the meantime. Until she expired, of course, Acilia still insisted on her children dining with her regularly, preferably over an early morning meal in the Solaria atrium, so she could fill them in on their roles in whatever her latest conspiracy happened to be. He had long thought that their dining atrium matched his mother's temperament perfectly. The ceiling, open to the sky, and the delicate paintings on the walls and supporting columns surrounded them with constant reminders of their own wealth and good taste. The atrium was at the centre of their manor, however, surrounded by the upper floors on all sides, impervious to espionage or casual observation. The perfect place for the planning of subterfuge. Tanzeg loathed the Solaria atrium. It had been built by their grandfather, a paltry imitation of a larger and more elegant atrium in the Matkinsons' summer home in Trencavie Bay. Faisal the Nason had intended to prove that anything the Matkinsons could accomplish, he could as well. But to Tanzeg's eyes, it was merely a cheap copy.
"So?"
Tanzeg, rolling his eyes at Irena.
"What of it?"
Most nobles preferred to have children who were as insidious as they were to serve as willing partners in their machinations. Others chose instead to raise the most vapid, loyal pawns that could still manage to string two words together without drooling, in order to ensure their rule for as long as possible without fear of being usurped. Whenever Tanzeg looked at Irena, he couldn't escape the feeling that their mother had tried to hedge her bets with the best of both worlds. While he was capable of his own plots, or serving as an able second in his mother's schemes if he was forced to, his younger sister had no such capabilities. Acilia had raised him to lead, but kept his clay-headed sister in the wings in case Tanzeg's reach exceeded his grasp, and Acilia was forced to have a suspicious accident befall her heir. Such thoughts might be abhorrent to many parents, but his mother had always valued pragmatism. and like the hand-wringing Matkissons sending their excess heirs off-world to become Arbites, the Venaissons had always been the more practical family. He and Irena had had an additional 3 siblings, all of whom had perished tragically young.
So?
Acilia said. His mother's face, normally so impassive, contorted into a brief moment of rage before she regained her composure. He sneered at her lapse.
So strengthening her position doesn't exactly work in our favour.
He snorted.
A brief surge in public opinion is strengthening her position now. How terrible for us.
Tanzeg put a hand to his head as if feeling faint.
Oh no, whatever shall I do? Suddenly my rival is armed with the favour of peasants. What a nightmare.
He rolled his eyes and took a sip of his recaff.
The loyalty of our specialists is a greater asset than any warm feelings the masses may have for our dear leader, he said.
Acilia glowered at him.
Speaking of our specialists,
chirped Irena,
I haven't seen Lestrovsky for some time.
She beamed, glancing around as if Tanzeg's toady would materialise in accordance with her wishes. Not that Tanzeg or his mother would ever have dreamed of allowing a low-born gutter cretin like Lestrovsky into the Solaria atrium. Tanzeg loathed Irena. Despite being in her early 80s, she'd pushed the vanity of juvenat treatments and cosmetic surgery to extremes bordering on the ridiculous. She had frozen her age in her late teens, with her frizzy hair and loose splatter of freckles. Most assuredly dyed in. No Venaissin had ever had such blemishes naturally. Puppy fat curves and beaming wide-eyed stares. His mother caught his eye, and Tanzeg cleared his throat. He picked up the news sheet and examined the headlines disinterestedly.
Lestrovsky will be away for a while, he said,
which was true. After all, if the little shit had been captured alive, he would already have spilled his guts, and all of the Venaissins would be in custody at that very moment, or at least fleeing for their lives through black market channels. More likely, he had been killed trying to finish the job on that miserable Matkissan girl, or otherwise had failed and escaped Darkadin and gone to ground. Tanzeg wasn't sure which of these options left the least possibility of Lestrovsky's involvement being traced back to him.
It might behove on you to keep tabs on him, said Acilia,
carrying on the pretense of innocence.
It would be a shame if a valued creature like that were acquired by another party.
Tanzeg stared intently at the news sheet, sipping his recaff slowly.
Indeed,
he said. Chapter 5. Have we made any progress on finding the assassins? Ashel's expression remained commanding, even whilst propped up against the headboard of her four-poster. She folded her hands in her lap and glared. Her Medicaid may have insisted on bed rest, but she would be damned if that would stop her from ministering to her affairs. To encourage her to rest, her servants had kept the thick maroon drapes of her bedchamber closed, casting the room back into darkness. The rolling rainy season was continuing apace, of course, so even throwing the curtains wide did little to illuminate the room. Even at midday, the sky was an oppressive grey, the threat of another thunderstorm always hanging in the air. Her servants had done their best to encourage her convalescence, no doubt at the Medicaid's direction. The spiral carved posts of her bed had been hung with allium flowers to soothe. All her accoutrements of business had been neatly tucked away in the drawers of the thick-legged work desk. The directions she'd laid out for the modifications had been fulfilled in record time. The Baroque paintings her father had preferred had been removed and replaced by pieces from her own collection, as if the Dolores landscapes she'd collected would somehow heal her own scrapes and bruises faster. None of it helped, of course. That very morning she had woken from sleep convinced she could see burning red eyes watching her from the shadows, hidden in the gloom of the canopy above her bed. She'd lain there, frozen in terror, watching the eyes stare back at her, until full wakefulness had come and she realised she had only dreamt them.
No, ma'am.
Group Captain Barron lacked his predecessor's ease in her presence. He stood stiffly, his hands folded behind his back, as if on parade rest in front of a superior officer. Technically, of course, she was, but it was a stiffness she wasn't used to from the high service. Fidel Barron wouldn't have been her first choice for Zalukin's replacement. He had been recruited into the Shokan Air Corps from the Wardens and had very little military experience. Worse, she didn't know him personally at all. Group Captain Barron had done his service entirely on the southern continents before transferring to the high service. Barring the presentation of his service honours, which the governor and his children always attended, neither of them had seen the other before her father's death. Commodore Zalukin had trusted Group Captain Barron implicitly, however. He was the first staff member the Commodore had investigated and cleared, before naming Barron as his second in command. You're investigating the Venaissance? Ashiel had no doubt as to who had been behind the attack on her, but it wasn't as though she could acknowledge such publicly. Lostrovsky's body was the only evidence tying the Coadjutor family directly to the assassination attempt, and the assassin's corpse was still lying somewhere in the cavern below Darkadon. Without presentable evidence, she might have been able to have a common citizen arrested and disposed of, but an entire noble family couldn't be vanished overnight without some kind of inquiry. The Venaissans had too many in the Grevenate that allowed the coadjutors their loyalty. They would make her life difficult if their patrons were to be persecuted en masse. Barron nodded.
Yes, ma'am. The Lady Venaisson was in the company of several representatives of the Grevenate at the time of the attack, and Arena Venaisson was seen in the company of half a dozen young men until the early hours of the morning. Only Tanzeg's whereabouts remain unaccounted for. As he was the only member of the inner family we considered a suspect, this doesn't give us any new revelations.
How so? Said Ashiel.
Lady Acilia's physical infirmity makes her unsuited to midnight assassinations, ma'am, and the detailed elimination of four of the high service, along with the meticulous nature of this operation, led us to discount Irena Venaisson as well.
But you're sure Irena's alibis check out?
I am, ma'am. We confirmed her presence at the House of Ill Repute with several independent witnesses, including those not intimately connected with her.
He coughed and glanced away from her.
From what I can see in Commodore Zalukin's files, she isn't one to have the wherewithal to orchestrate such an action.
Ashiel smiled a little at his awkward formality. Don't discount her so readily, she said. Irena Venaisson may be the most dangerous of the lot. To his credit, Group Captain Barron didn't contradict her or show any signs of doubt openly.
My apologies, ma'am. Our records show a consistent pattern of behaviour going back years.
Ashiel sighed. No doubt, Group Captain. Her cow-eyed debutante routine has been carefully polished over the course of decades. It is, however, a facade. She's as sadistic and cunning as anyone else in her family. Barron nodded.
Once again, my apologies, ma'am. There was nothing about this in Commodore Zalukin's files.
She straightened in the bed. I think you'll find that there's a great deal which is not in the files that you'll be expected to learn, Group Captain. Above a certain social stratum, there are some things which cannot be entrusted to paper. At least not to those papers which one's subordinates will have access. Barron nodded again. Ashiel sighed.
In that regard, ma'am, I'd like to look at bringing in a specialist team to try to seek out the assassin below the palace.
He shifted slightly. Ashiel wished he didn't insist on maintaining a military posture in her presence. She and Zalukin had been close enough that he could be relaxed around her, and she found the group captain's stiffness to be mildly contagious. Absolutely not, she said. As it was in the time of my father, the chambers beneath the palace are to be kept locked, and entry into them forbidden. This was a sore spot with them. The group captain had been pressing to investigate the tunnels ever since she had been found in the buttery, her dressing gown soaked with blood and cavern filth.
I understand your trepidation, ma'am, but the investigation would greatly benefit from...
There's nothing else to say on the topic, Group Captain Barron, she said. The friendly tone was gone now. She needed to make certain there was no ambiguity. I commend you for your diligence in this regard, that those tunnels are condemned not for secrecy, but for safety. The substructures they lead to are unstable and dangerous in the extreme.
The story she had given them had been as close to the truth as possible. Beneath the palace, she had discovered the ruins of far older structures. That in itself was not terribly shocking. It stood to reason that the governor's palace had been built on a site of ancient rulership or significance. While it was true that the ruins gave way to natural cavern formations, she had given them a rather more fanciful account of their breadth and decrepitude. Barron knew, too, that her would-be assassin was dead, or presumed dead, and subsequently entombed behind locked doors. In the version she had imparted to her subordinates, however, the killer who had been pursuing her had fallen into a chasm. She'd been quite incoherent when they found her, barely able to maintain consciousness. The medicae had concluded her weak state was due to the blood loss from her attack, coupled with the cold environ below the palace. They'd asked about her injuries, of course. Her arms were covered in raw scrapes where she'd been drawn from the chimney. There was a fading bruise high on her head where Lestrovsky had struck her. She declined to discuss the attack in detail and had simply told the medicae, Barron, and her brother that she had suffered her injuries while fending off her attacker. She knew that explaining the specifics of any of the wounds would mean explaining them all, and she hadn't been able to concoct a specific lie about her missing finger. "Are preparations for the ball in place?" she asked, to forestall any further questions about the caverns. He nodded stiffly.
"Indeed. Is Her Excellency quite certain I can't convince her to postpone, or at least to limit the size of the guest list?"
Achelle's eyes narrowed, and she fought down the urge to throw something heavy at the group captain. She reminded herself that providing for her security was his job, after all.
"Quite certain," she said. "Our staff is reduced, Group Captain. Our family reduced in size and influence. If I am to maintain my office, and quite frankly, my life, I must present a strong and stable image to the Grevenate, lest any of them begin to court some foolish notion about placing the coadjutor on the throne. That means the devotional banquet must proceed."
Normally the highlight of the Shokan social calendar, the devotional banquet was a holdover from the days of planetary warfare, where rulers would invite their officers and subordinate chieftains to swear renewed oaths of fealty and to renew their own vows of stewardship. It had evolved into a ceremony to celebrate and form alliances, where inter-house marriages were proposed and new business ventures cemented. To Ashiel's mind, the proximity to Ruprecht's death made this year's banquet a ghoulish procession of those anxious to see how she was settling into her role. She would be expected to mediate disputes and settle grievances, and all eyes would be on her for the slightest slip.
"And my brother?" she asked, keen to move on.
"Reporting events here to Judge Idenel aboard the Calistonian Haven, ma'am."
The group captain hedged for a moment, as if uncertain to offer his personal observation.
"I believe he may also be attempting to feel out the judge's feelings regarding the Venason family and their involvement with the assassination."
"He and I have already discussed that matter," Ashiel said, "and I suspect he'll find little has changed, with no tangible evidence to present. Still, there's no harm in him trying."
Despite her insistence that she didn't need as much rest as those around her believed, she was growing weary.
"If there's nothing else in the immediate, I would take my rest."
Group Captain Barron nodded, saluted crisply, and left her bedchamber with a sharp twist of his heel. She stared into the corners of the bedchamber for some time. The sconces in the wall glowed, turned up to their maximum setting. But still there were shadows that couldn't be banished. She gazed at the darkness beneath the feet of her cloak wardrobe, wondering if something lurked beneath, peering back at her. Achelle sank into her pillows, no longer concerned with appearances now she was alone. She pulled the soft duvet up to her chin and stared unblinkingly at the walls. The governor's bedchamber was surprisingly devoid of ornamentation, with plain walls and worn wooden floors. Her own sleeping quarters had been much more lavish as a child, with cabbage roses engraved in silver set into the wooden columns, and an expansive starscape painted across her ceiling, depicting whirling comets, brilliant nebulae and burning stars. The bedchamber she had taken over from her father was no peasant's hovel, but it had also clearly not been designed or decorated with the thought or desire that the governor spend a great deal of time there. The art pieces the servants had hung during her recovery were the only personal touches to the decor. Achelle knew if her circumstances had been different. If she had been relegated to bed rest only a month ago, she would have gone mad just sitting in that room. It seemed like every day brought the same thing now. When her aides and her underlings came to her, she could rouse herself, could scrape her mind together into some semblance of functionality. But as soon as they left, she fell apart like a marionette with the strings cut. She found herself staring into space for hours. Some days she realized she'd skipped several meals in a row. Although she always allowed her maids to turn down her lights when they believed she was going to sleep, she always turned them up again as soon as the room was empty. When she did sleep, she did it with the room fully lit. That was when she could sleep, which was rare. The image of Lostrovsky's terrified face, frozen in the las pistol flash, kept haunting her. The sound of his screams echoing off the stone walls followed her into her dreams. At her best, in the middle of the night, she insisted to herself over and over that there had been no other choice, no other way to survive. In the terrible light of each dawn, with the cathedral bells tolling out across the city, she knew better. She was damned. She sighed. There was too much at stake for her to continue this way. Millions of people across her planet were dependent on her, heretic or not. She knew that she needed to pull herself together, that she couldn't lie in her bed, trapped between fear and regret forever. She had to rise, to prove to her enemies that they could not defeat her. Achelle pulled the duvet over her mouth and nose, leaving only her eyes exposed. She stared at the wall to her side, her eyes unblinking. Tomorrow. She would rise tomorrow. Across Costovium, unseen eyes watched from the shadows. The flowing, rushing form was too swift and too ephemeral to be spotted by mortal eyes, but its effects could be felt by the exceptionally sensitive. But it watched them, nevertheless. A thousand scenes of mundane torment spread before it like a feast before a prisoner starved. In a corner of a glazier's storefront, it found the craftsman's apprentice huddled in a corner, tears staining the boy's face, his ribs still aching with the dull soreness of the drunken beating his master had given him. The thing in the shadows loomed over the boy, close enough to smell the salt on the child's cheeks, before moving on in search of more varied prey. Screams of agony drew it to a flakboard home in the oldest part of the city. A rich aura of pain emanated from a candlelit room, where the shadow found a cluster of humans attending a woman in the throes of childbirth. From the shadowy corner it stared, its thin black lip curled up in revulsion. There was pain here, true, and fear aplenty, but it was spoilt by a flood of joy and hope as well. It drew a deep breath, savouring what sustenance it could take from the corrupted offering, and then was gone. In the shrouded alleys, it paused to watch a man being gutted over a gambling debt. Even after the knife-wielding perpetrators fled into the night, it lingered over the fallen victim, drinking the man's agony as he tried to crawl across the cobbles to some imagined safety. The victim was sotted, his senses dulled by drink, so his fear and pain were only a fraction of what they might have been. After centuries of starvation, the pricks and stings of the city were a joy and a hideous curse to the shadow. Each new sufferance was burning, crimson relief. A draught of wine to a man dying of thirst. Yet each sip was torment. Almost better to have nothing at all than to have too little. Centuries had passed with only floating wisps of sustenance, and now it was forced to accept a trickle when a flood was demanded. Was there for the taking before its very claws. Down the alleys it flickered and flowed back to the palace, back to the place of its imprisonment, back to the site of its freedom. The scuttling guards took no notice of it. Why would they? To them it was a shadow on a moonless night. It was as much a part of the background as the stones of the wall, as the paintings of governors past that had hung there for centuries. It paused as it passed the strutting figure of the major domo. Shadowy fingers extended, stroking the air just behind the marching man's exposed neck. The soldier paused, feeling the chill run up his spine, and turned. The shadow flowed as effortlessly as sin, flattening against the wall as the soldier's gaze fixed on the empty hallway. It thrilled at the spooky chill which emanated from the major domo, who turned back to his path and marched on, his stride slightly quickened by the unexplained sense of dread. So little it knew, but soon there would be so much. The teeming, filthy herds of humanity had grown fat during its long incarceration. The air was choked with the stench of their sweat, their heaving breath, their bleating, braying voices. It was a world of prey, who had forgotten that predators even existed. The shadow flowed once more into the master bedroom where its patron slept fitfully. It knelt by her bedside, its burning eyes staring at her slumbering features. Only a mild unease floated from her now. In the first nights of its freedom, she had been plagued by the horrors she had witnessed, the churning nocturnal terrors occasionally driving her to wake screaming. Time had salved her wound, as it did, but the shadow knew that was inevitable. The air held the thinnest scent of a far richer taste, however. The taste of remorse was one of the rarest in the world. More than a pain of the body, it was a pain of the soul. Only a spark now, but the human gently slumbering in the bed, her mind only occasionally stirring with the faintest notions of what she'd unleashed, held the potential for a far grander feast to come. If there was one building on Shokan that dwarfed even the governor's palace for its size and ostentation, it was the central cathedral in Kostovium. The massive church had been built in the low-lying central portion of the city, as the focus of the Great Reconstruction. Building materials had been brought in from far away to construct the house of worship. So high were its vaulted ceilings that the carmine roof tiles were visible at any point in the city proper. The central tower rose high enough that travellers could use its illumination as a navigation point during stormy nights. The governor's carriage threaded through the wrought iron gates. Several of the penitent brigade moved to close the gates behind her. Despite its size and grandeur, the Cathedral of Kostovium was too small to warrant protection from the Ecclesiarchy's trained militants. Instead, its defence was seen to by the volunteer penitents, those citizens of Shokan who pledged their lives and service to the Ministerium in exchange for sustenance and shelter. Ashiel noted with some discomfort that she had never seen so many penitents before. Even as a child, the notion of accepting a penitent's habit had been seen as an act of desperation, something only accepted by former criminals or outcasts. Now, the cathedral had them employed not only as guards and sentries, but menials and servants. The facade of the cathedral had been commissioned and completed after the Great Reconstruction, and had been intended to send an ironclad message. a reminder that the attentions of the Imperium might wax or wane in their intensity, but the presence of him upon the throne was eternal. The grand doors had been made from a lustrous grey metal that had never shown signs of abrasion, corrosion, or degradation in the millennia since their installation. The rose window above them was large enough to fly a landing craft through, and studded with basal crystal panels in a dizzy kaleidoscope of colours. Images of great men in ancient power armour flanked the rose window, their war plate decorated with the Ultima. At the apex of the facade, the Emperor of Mankind stood in profile, his noble gaze cast to the east. In the middle of the night, on Reunification Day, his gaze into the night sky lined up with the direction of Holy Terror. His graven visage seeing the distant star that mortal eyes could never discern in the blackness. Behind him, the great Aquila spread its bronze wings. The thoroughfare was blocked to carriages beyond the great entry, forcing visitors beyond that to proceed on foot. The blockade was topped by a statue of Saint Sebastian, his unforgiving visage graven in black marble shot through with veins of gold. The pilasters of the facade were embellished with images of lesser saints, elongated to fit the proportions of the fake columns. Ashiel was surprised to find the deacon waiting for her near Sebastian Thor's stone feet. Petty displays of power were common among high-ranking luminaries, and she had come with every expectation of being made to wait, or at least being escorted inside and treated to a display of Phoebean's power and resources. Instead, the deacon met her at the narthex of the great cathedral. A small flock of attendants crowded around her. Most of her entourage consisted of lower-ranking clergy, but near the back, Ashiel could see two or three scarred, dead-eyed faces she imagined were still being diligently sought by enforcers in some part of the world or other. "Your Eminence," Ashiel said. One of the attendants slid a stool in front of the deacon, and Ashiel lowered her knees to the cushion's surface. "Your Excellency." Deacon Phoebean held her hand out to the young governor, who dutifully bent her knee and brushed her lips across the adamantium aquila on the deacon's finger. At the official state function, such as her father's funeral, the governor would not normally be required to genuflect. Since she was the one calling on the deacon unbidden, it was customary to offer a show of deference to the ministerium. "Did I call at an inopportune time?" Ashiel asked, regarding the deacon's entourage. She dismissed her own guards with a flick of her fingers. Sullenly, both men stepped back to stand guard over the carriage. A small spike of pain lanced through her hand as she stood, and she rubbed a silver cap on the end of her missing finger. "Hardly," said Deacon Phoebean. "I was just out taking my exercise. I thought a little walk along the Saints' Arcade would afford us the time to talk to your satisfaction." Of course, such a venue would also offer the elderly deacon a plausible excuse to end the conversation at any time by claiming fatigue. Clever, Ashiel realised. "What can I do for you, Excellency?" Ashiel fell in with the deacon, uncertain of how candid she would be able to be if the deacon's followers accompanied them the entire way. To her relief, the hangers-on fell away immediately. The deacon set off down the arcade with a measured stride that belied her frail frame. The stone arches of the arcade shielded them from the sun. "I wanted to talk to you about history, Your Eminence." Ashiel didn't want to dance around the topic, but at the same time she wasn't going to put all her cards on the table at once, lest the deacon suddenly reveal a fanaticism deep enough to impugn even a governor.
"In what regard?"
"What do you know of Shokan's history prior to the Great Restoration?" The deacon nodded.
"I thought that might be what you wanted to discuss," she said. "Was there anything specific you were curious about?"
Ashiel smiled. Getting herself out of bed had taken an extreme act of will. In her mind, it had been easier to take her own finger off. But now that she was in the moment, matching her own wits against another woman of high station, she found her drive and confidence returning. I've been reading through my father's notes, she lied, and I came across a mention of a town in Garenbos, specifically a construction project that unearthed an old Shoke burial mound. The deacon nodded again, a contemplative expression on her face. Ashiel had to admire the old woman for her ability to keep up the wizened sage act. She would be willing to bet her last coin that Phoebian had never heard of any construction project in Garenbos. There was money on whether the deacon even knew which of her ministers was in charge in Garenbos. Phoebian was playing it the way she would have, though, had Ashiel been in the deacon's position. What I mean to ask is, do you know why the old Shoke are so feared? Ashiel did her best to project a little trepidation into her voice. If the old woman wanted to play the role of a learned scholar, she was happy to act as the part of a wide-eyed student.
The old Shoke are not feared, child, the deacon beamed,
clearly thrilled to be back in a familiar, authoritative role, now that she believed she had a clear idea of what the governor wanted.
The forces of the emperor laid low the heretics in their midst and freed the population that had laboured beneath profane rule for so long. The dangers of the old Shoke are gone, never to return. True children of mankind never fear such base heretics, of course. We pity them as we cleanse their corruption.
Ashiel smiled and hesitated, then nodded.
Of course, she said,
meeting the deacon's gaze and then looking away. I just meant, why are we so vigilant for the relics of their culture? Surely any remains of their society should be preserved as monuments to our success. My father taught me that war trophies of the emperor's faithful are sacred, and that it was heresy to destroy them. The deacon stopped walking and laid a patronizing hand on Ashiel's shoulder.
Fear not, my child. It is well that Shoken has one so pious as you to steward her.
Phoebian resumed her pained shuffling.
You speak true, but for those of such elevated positions as we, there is a higher duty. We must protect the hearts and souls of the lives entrusted to our care. So foul were the perversions of the old Shoke that even to know of their existence would corrupt the living.
You speak of dark powers, of sorcery.
Ashiel made the sign of the Aquila. Deacon Phoebian turned and regarded her, glanced around as if fearful of being overheard, and then nodded gravely. Ashiel dropped her gaze, feigning terror. A month earlier, unearthing a secret history of sorcery on her world might have been genuinely horrifying, but the discovery of the vile creature such sorcery had been meant to contain had adjusted her standards for horror somewhat.
The very thought fills me with dread, she said. The thought that someone might unearth some heretical ritual, that I might have apostates working foul magics within the population I am sworn to protect.
I'm not surprised, the deacon sighed.
Ashiel clamped down on her shock. How much did Phoebian know?
How do you mean?
Ashiel said carefully.
Preacher Larachin told me your father made similar inquiries after his ascendancy, Phoebe replied. It stands to reason that there are a number of sensitive matters that only a planetary governor is trusted enough to deal with.
The deacon paused, leaning her hand against one wall of the cathedral, looking for all the world like nothing more dangerous than a winded old lady.
Do you recognize this image?
She asked. Ashiel had ceased paying attention to the decorations and refocused on them. Between the pilasters of the wall, adorned with their grotesquely stretched saints, the walls of the arcade had been decorated with marble reliefs. It depicted the soldiers with the ultima, the same ones that had stood guard over the cathedral doors. Ashiel had seen similar figures on the gates of the Korgana militant. They hefted mighty bolters and huge swords, and were locked in fierce battle with twisted, abstract forms.
I assume the larger figures are Adeptus Astartes, she said, although she had never seen such a being in life or image.
fighting monsters of law.
Indeed, said the deacon, the forces of the reunification.
Phoebean pointed to another figure rising above the others. It looked smaller in frame than the angels of death that it led, and had a spindly frame with a long forked beard.
Led by Alan Drew the Confessor.
Deacon Phoebean made the sign of the Aquila.
Great men who sacrificed much, including many of their own lives, to leave their legacy to us, to you in particular.
Ashel nodded as if seeing the wisdom of the deacon. How disappointing. She had been hoping the deacon would have some more concrete notions on opposing the forces in league with the old Shoke. I shall not fail to honour it, she said.
If you are plagued by fear, the deacon said, keep tight to your legacy.
She reached out with one aged hand to tap the bas-relief of St. Alan Drew.
Particularly the rod that St. Alan Drew gave to the first governor of the reunified Shoken. The same rod he used to smite the unholy.
Ashiel smiled, honestly this time. Is it the same rod of office that was passed down to me?
Deacon Phoebean beamed as the student got it. The very same, Preacher Larichan tells me.
Ashiel bowed again. Your Eminence, she said, you've given me much to strengthen my spirits.
Chapter 6.
Ostap was, quite simply, outmatched. Our duty, as an assembly, is to the people of Shoken, he said, not just to the wealthy of Costovium.
Those who had been called before the Grevenate, the witnesses and experts arrayed in the Occurium, could scarcely hear him. That was fine. His words weren't meant for them. The audio veins in his alcove picked up his words and transferred them to the alcoves of all the other members. He could have activated his amplifier if he'd so wished, but this particular issue did not involve any members of the public, and Minister Fominko didn't feel the need for grandstanding. Margrethe Bruziel had no such discretion.
Just so, as Minister Fominko says.
The Margrave's voice boomed from the amplifiers, echoing in the open space of the basilica like a roll of argumentative thunder.
We must think of the citizens of Shoken, but that includes those of our own city. If we allow the Tupikamin evacuees to settle in Costovium, it will create a drain on local resources. We have our own unfortunates to care for, after all.
Tianesh's alcove in the third tier was on the wall above his own, preventing Ostap from looking at her directly. The hollow screen built into the top of his desk displayed the face of each current speaker, however reminding all of the lords who held the floor and allowing them to see one another, albeit in a scratchy blue and white colour shift.
I remind Lady Bruzel that this assembly speaks on behalf of all of Shoken. The evacuees are our own unfortunates.
Longrev Ivanova was one of the few voices from the upper tiers who could reliably be counted on to support the ground level, especially when the issue concerned the Matkinsons and their agenda or legacy.
We have already received an affirmative response to the missive we drafted to the palace. Lord Governor Matkinson stands prepared to authorise emergency food allotments to the displaced through her own holdings. Their care and feeding will pose no burden to the citizens of Costovium.
Despite Lord Evanova's support, Ostap could see the currents of discussion and knew it would be a difficult battle to get the evacuees cared for. Burrowing vermin had destabilised large portions of the cliffs the city of